Welcome, everybody, to episode 2 of the rebranded Bomber Brothers podcast, now part of the Pinstripe Alley community. Sean and Ryan with you. We'll also have Tyler Kepner of the New York Times on to talk about the latest surrounding the Yankees and his book K, an awesome book diving deep into the mind of a pitcher, which everyone should go out and grab a copy of. But for now, before we get to that, Sean, there's a lot of catching up to do, and by catching up, I mean a lot of new injuries to recap since we last spoke. We've got Sanchez on the IL now. We've got Severino shut down again. We have Betances with his shoulder spur shut down for the next 6 or 7 weeks. And now, just minutes before we start recording, which is kind of dangerous to record nowadays because you're probably going to miss a new injury, but now Greg Bird with a plantar fascia tear is off to the 10-day IL, bringing up Mike Ford, an undrafted free agent signing back in 2013, who, as Gio Gonzalez quoted Mike Ford as being ghost pepper. That's how hot he is right now in AAA. So hopefully he brings that to the majors, because there's not much offensive production left on the big league club.
Well, I tweeted this out about half an hour ago after the Bird injury broke. I don't know if you saw it. The last night of the 2017 season, 4-0 loss to Houston. We were upset. We came within one of the World Series, but we also felt very hopeful. That was, you know, that was a year and a half ago now. The only players that are not hurt from that lineup are Gardner, Judge, and Torres replacing Castro. Andujar, who replaced Frazier, is on the IL. Stanton, who replaced Headley, is on the IL. And everybody else is on the IL. Even Didi's replacement, Tulowitzki, is. So three players, one of them is aged, you know, into his late 30s. So Judge and Torres are the only players from that lineup, which are big league caliber players. So, yeah, we're screwed. We're going to have to start podcasting every other day, because there's just too much to talk about with all this crap that we found out. Severino's news is terrible. It's worse that they don't know how it happened. I mean, even Cashman was saying they're trying to figure out how you have a grade 2. It's not like a small, it's not a grade 1 strain. It's a grade 2 latch strain. So I figured you would have a general idea of how that happened. The Betances thing is also really bad. I mean, for a pitcher with a shoulder injury, that's devastating. And I mean, the Sanchez thing, if he's going to the IL and he's sitting down, why is he pinch hitting then? I mean, why didn't you just get it taken care of that day and get an MRI instead of waiting? Just with all the shit that's going on, take care of it. So am I allowed to still curse on this new platform?
Yeah. We can just change the setting from clean to explicit when we publish it. So you can
this
have
one's going
to
be explicit.
Yeah, the first one was clean, so I guess we can alternate back and forth every week. But the way things are going, it's actually probably going to be an explicit streak that will eclipse Joe DiMaggio if the season keeps going the way it is. Because not only is everyone injured, the Yankees are losing series to the Orioles, the Tigers, and the White Sox at home. And
but they turned the corner after the Astros series. I was told that they were turning the corner.
Yeah, well, Boone is optimistic about a lot of things, and
He really thinks they're in a sound place as far as our focus, energy, and expectations when we walk through these doors. How are they in a sound place with their focus and energy after that disaster of a finale in Houston, when you got Clint Frazier dropping fly balls, Gardner not running out balls? I mean, how can you feed me this BS?
Yeah, that was an awful, awful sloppy series in Houston, and then there was sloppy weather the next day in against Chicago, when they lose that series opener on Friday. And then Saturday happens, and CC comes back, and you almost don't know what to do with yourself, because you're used to players going to the IL, not coming back from it. But then here comes CC, pitches unbelievable. Everyone's laughing in the clubhouse after the game. Judge says, you know, this could be the start of something, and then they follow it up with the what feels like inevitable occasional clunker from Tanaka. Even though he had been great to start the season, he does not follow that up on a Sunday. Gave up a grand slam to Tim Anderson, who is, I don't even know what his OPS is right now, but he's somehow one of the hottest hitters in that division, and the Yankees can't score any runs to make a comeback, and they drop another series, and now there's a two-game series with Boston on deck, and it's not going to carry the same weight as many people thought it would before the series started, because not only do the Yankees stink, the Red Sox do too.
Yeah, both of them are struggling, and I guess if you want to take solace in something, it's like that old, okay, well, you did something wrong, well, so did you. I mean, I would just rather be winning baseball games than have both of us suck. 6-9 is not the start I was hoping for. I too thought, you know what, CeCe did pitch a very inspiring performance on Saturday. That was a nice little uplift, especially after blowing the lead like they did on Friday. Again, I mean, how many leads are we going to lose this season? And I know you're going to argue with me on this, but to me, it comes back to the player performance. I understand that the players need to perform, but they also need to be put in the best possible position. And Aaron Boone is not the man for this job. Joe Girardi would take a team like this and at least make something out of it. I am convinced Girardi would have this team at least two extra wins. Maybe they'd be 8-7, but that's better than 6-9. And the way that he's always like a batter behind with the bullpen, and then he comes out with these kumbaya quotes about how they're doing all right. I'm sorry. Like, you know what? The manager doesn't need to be a nice guy all the time. It's good that he has personal relationships with the players, but you can have a personal relationship with the player and still demand a certain set of standards from them in terms of focus. I understand performance. You can't control that. I mean, look, we both play like rec league baseball, and you know as well as I do, I can't hit for shit, and I try as hard as I can. But there's other things in your game that you can control, and even the Yankees don't do those things right. The fundamentals fail them, and the manager should be able to squeeze as much as he can out of this team, and he's not doing it. I'm really disappointed in Boone, and I'm gonna bring this all the way back to the beginning. Cashman had my trust, and like Ricky Ricardo said, I trusted him with his life, but he's been on a downward spiral since he fired Girardi.
Well, he fired Girardi and then got Giancarlo Stanton.
Giancarlo Stanton was dumped in his lap.
He still got him. I don't know.
Because he wouldn't go anywhere.
You're also all right.
It was like an arranged marriage. He didn't win him over. He had something else to do.
All right. Well, how do you explain Luke Voit?
All right, that's a good one.
All right, so it's not a downward spiral.
But we're talking about in the aggregate. We got, first of all, he fires Joe Girardi, who had done an amazing job. I understand that him and Sanchez didn't get along, but you know what? Like, managers don't get along with players all the time. He was still a sound tactical manager. Then he goes, if you really want to fire Girardi, like, if there was really a problem there that I don't know about, I'm okay with that. I'm 100% okay admitting that there's things going on in the Yankees that I have no friggin' idea about. And that's true. That's true for anybody that's not in the organization, even the beat writers, right? But why do you go and hire somebody like Boone with no experience? You could have hired Bam Bam over there in San Francisco. That would have been a better choice. Shit, Eric Wedge would have been a better choice at this point.
I would have liked Beltran. He can tell when someone's tipping pitches.
That's true, and we'll get to that. that probably would have been a better choice. I don't know, but I mean, then he goes out this offseason and gets Britton, who stunk. He gets Hap, who stunk.
All right, hang on. The Hap signing so far, the Hap re-signing so far, has been bad.
Yes.
Through a couple starts.
Well, that's the
Hap
thing.
Trade was a huge win.
Yeah, but you can't give an old pitcher Patrick Corbin's out there pitching great. Machado's already got – oh, and the Tulowitzki signing. Don't even get me started about that. Machado's already at one win above replacement. It's April 16th. He's already at one win above replacement. What's Tulo doing? Sitting there stretching his calves?
Probably not. They'll tear. But I'm completely with you on all the Machado, the Corbin stuff. I think there should have been much more done to possibly bring those guys in than just putting their faces on the Jumbotron in center field. And the Yankees are paying for it, not going big game hunting like they hinted they would. And back to Boone, you know, just because I said that I feel like pitchers need to be doing their job a little more and then it's not all on Boone and then everyone thought I was this Boone supporter, I don't think Boone's doing a great job. I don't think his in-game managing is great, but I also think the Yankees aren't leaving him with a ton of great options because everyone he's been throwing out there has not been doing good. from starters aside from, well, Tanaka until Sunday, and then CeCe came back on Saturday. The bullpen has not been good. The Super Death Star bullpen has not been good at all. So I think it's also a lot of just the fact that guys aren't doing their job. And I understand people, for some reason, people want to see guys laid into and called out, and that just doesn't necessarily work all the time. I mean, Joe Torre was a lot like Boone in his early years. He was the don't panic, everybody stay calm, everything's fine, and nobody said anything because the Yankees won World Series, and instead of, you know, being called soft like Boone is, like, oh, and everyone making fun of his kumbaya relationships with the players, instead Torre was just seen as, you know, the player whisperer, the guy that just kept the clubhouse in sync. And then, you know, and then the core of that team stayed intact, and Steinbrenner started bringing in a lot of other outside stars, and that's when, you know, according to a lot of reporters, Torre started to lose the locker room, and the Yankees stopped winning World Series. So I just don't see the correlation between reaming guys out and getting wins. I just don't see the correlation there.
I don't need him or want him to ream a guy out, but I mean, let's be clear about something. Joe Torre, while he was a good player's manager, he was not afraid to call out one of his players if he needed to. He said he thought David Wells was out of shape when he ran out of gas at that start in Texas or whatever. He came back and threw a perfect game the next week. I mean, he was hungover, but I mean, that's one thing. But that's like, you don't need to go, you know, you don't need to come in and say, you know, Clint Frazier sucks. He dropped like three balls or you know, took some terrible routes on some fly balls. He just needs to say, you know, we need to work on a couple of things. Like, obviously, the way that we're playing right now is not acceptable. He doesn't need to call anybody out. But don't say, like, oh, we're about to turn the corner after you turn in that. Or he could say, you know, like, Gardner knows he has to do that. It was a mental error. Like just give us a little accountability. That's all. You don't need to say. We know Brett Gardner is a tough, gritty player who usually always does the right thing. But just don't pretend that it's not an issue. You don't need to demean a guy over it. I mean, honestly, I never thought that Girardi was demeaning about Sanchez. He just, you know, he expected a certain level. And I always thought that he was fair with him, but apparently not. And I mean, yeah, he doesn't have a lot to work with, but I mean, this is how the Yankees opened up in 2013. And I'm always going to go back to this. You had Nunez batting second, Youkilis batting fourth, Vernon Wells batting fifth, Ben Francisco batting sixth, Jason Nix batting eighth, and Francisco Cervelli
batting.
And we
were at that opening day.
And we were at that game. And he had that team in first place at the end of April.
Yeah, no, look, Girardi did masterful jobs mining through a lot of injuries and getting the most out of guys like Lyle Overbay and what have you. And, you know, he also had his faults. And, you know, I don't know. I keep going back to people wanting Boone to be a little more outgoing in his accountability. And look, that's not just a Boone thing. Like, this is a Yankees organization thing now. They don't want that. I'm about three quarters of the way through Inside the Empire by Bob Clappish, and he details like what the Yankees organization does in terms of grooming prospects that they bring in, whether it's through the draft or through international signings, and they literally instruct and teach players, you know, how to deal with the press and not single anybody out in their answers and to keep things as mellow as possible. And just, you know, Hal Steinbrenner, Brian Cashman, they have turned the organization into the anti-George Steinbrenner, basically, where it's not a zoo and it's not calling people out. And, you know, could there be a happy medium between that and the late 70s Yankees? Probably. But it's just not what the organ. I don't single out Boone on that because, you know, after reading all that stuff, it's an organization-wide thing. It's not just Boone, and they probably hired him because they saw that he fit that mold. He apparently really impressed in a 6-hour interview and seemed to embrace the analytic wave. And, you know, managers, I guess I just never saw the manager having a huge impact on the game itself, because so much is just the talent on the field. But you do. You have to make good in-game choices. Boone has not been great at that right now. So, you know, our disagreement simply lies in you think Boone's terrible, and I just think he's not good. So neither of them are positive.
Yeah, well, and, you know, like you said, it's an organizational thing, and it comes down from Cashman. And I mean, yeah, he's made some really great moves in the past. This offseason, I do not think he did a good job. And I thought he did a bad job with the manager. And I think he's done a bad job if that's his choice to have this kind of total kumbaya. Like at some, I mean, I agree. You have a young kid. You don't want to put him down, obviously. You don't. I mean, hazing and stuff like that, like, and even like being like that when you're trying to develop a player, tough on him. I understand it doesn't work for everybody. But once you get to the show, there just needs to be a level of accountability, in my opinion. And the Yankees aren't doing that.
Or maybe they are, just not in front of a microphone or behind a camera. I mean, we don't know.
That's fair. But, I mean, you know what? This is all I'll say. At least they're the luxury tax champions, and all the players are going to be happy because I'm not. I'm not happy, but at least all the players are going to go to bed with a smile on their face because they didn't get called out.
I just think that's misunderstood. I watch Aaron Judge in his post-game interviews after these losses, and he is not happy. He's just smart enough to hold his anger in until the press is gone because he doesn't want to cause more distraction. I mean, you can tell just by watching him talk after games that he's not happy. Why would he be? He hates to lose. So do all the Yankees, I'm sure. But they probably have been taught to push that aside until the reporters leave, and then, you know, and then hash out whatever needs to be hashed out. At least that's how I see it. And there's just a certain level of powerlessness right now. Like we mentioned the Tory Yankees. What was the biggest common denominator of those teams? They stayed healthy. The Red Sox last year, everybody stayed healthy. You know, Sale Sale fell off a little bit in the second half, but they were so far ahead and healthy through the rest of their roster that they were able to rest them for a little longer. And the Yankees are just the complete opposite right now. I think it would be interesting. I wish I had, you know, crunched these numbers or something to like calculate total wars or some kind of stat to help compare the two. But I feel like the injured Yankees right now would beat the current Yankees if you put them in a seven-game series or something.
If you got them all healthy, probably. But, yeah, I mean, you know, moving on to talk about the actual team because we're just, you know, speculating now and arguing over how terrible Boone is, whether he's a negative 10 or a negative 7, I guess you're probably going to rate him. I mean, the latest one with Bird is an interesting case to me. And, you know, I've always been a supporter of Greg Bird, but the last couple, I mean, since opening day, he's looked lost and he's looked like depressed at the plate. I mean, Paul O'Neill pointed it out. He looks like a man that's just searching for something that's not there. And now he's hurt. And I assume he hasn't been hurt the whole time because they would have probably figured it out sooner. So I don't know. I know we spoke to Mark about this last week. I don't know where this is going with him. He's one of the ones I could see not making it back, just like Ellsbury, not having an impact down the line. That makes me sad because, you know, he was a guy that when he came up in 2015, we all got really pumped about and we're like, wow, this is what the future is going to be. And there's more guys like this on the way. And then the guys on the way came and were really good. And he had his injuries, and then he came back in 2017, and you got pumped again, and since then it's just been all downhill. So I don't know if we're closing the book on Bird, but it sure feels that way today.
Yeah, Brandon, I think it was Brandon Cuddy that tweeted out, is the Bird era done in New York? And it's actually a legitimate question now, I feel like. Another injury, which came after he was posting something like a 550 OPS or something like that. He'd been dreadful. He's been really bad. Meanwhile, Luke Voit is, you know, still producing, getting on base. Obviously not the best fielder, but, you know, suddenly maybe the Yankees don't have to cling to Bird like they felt like they needed to in the past when their other option was like Chris Carter, who struck out every at bat he came to the plate. So there's not like a huge black hole at first base anymore. There's just one literally everywhere else in the field. But, you know, you go from one depressing story like that to a story in Mike Ford, who was an undrafted guy. Maybe can they catch lightning in a bottle? We'll see. 5 home runs in 10 AAA games. I know he went 0-for-5 in his last game, but maybe he's just saving those hits for the major leagues against the Red Sox. So I don't know. We'll see. I don't know if he'll how many at bats we'll get this brief 2-game series, we'll see. But Yeah, it's sad. It's sad to see Bird still struggling with injuries after struggling to produce. And what we always were saying through these first few weeks was, you know, the injuries aren't really an excuse right now. He's healthy and he's just not performing. Well, now he's both. And I guess we'll always have the swing and a drive to right in 2017. And as great as it is to look back on such an awesome moment like that, it also sucks to realize how young he still is and how that, you know, that could have been the norm for Bird, just mashing home runs into the upper deck and right field. But I don't know. Will he get another chance? We'll see. He has options. So I mean, they could always bring him up and down if they think he's healthy or not. But
yeah.
But who knows? But all right. Let's get to Tyler Kepner, and then we'll come back and talk a little more about plenty of Yankee stuff left to talk about. It's a little doom and gloom in Yankees universe right now, but let's talk to Tyler Kepner about his new book, K. He had a bunch of great stories from the perspective of pitchers in some of baseball's biggest moments, and plenty of them included Yankees, and he came on to talk to us about all of that and other things going on around the Yankees right now. So we'll take a quick break, and then we'll bring on Tyler Kepner of the New York Times. Okay, we're joined now by Tyler Kepner. He is the national baseball writer for the New York Times and also the author of the new book, K, which came out at the beginning of the month. It's a great book, and any baseball fan would absolutely love it. Tyler, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Sure, happy to be here.
So, you know, great book, obviously. It's a great deep dive into the mind of a pitcher, and there's a bunch of Yankees or former Yankees in there: Mike Mussina, Mariano Rivera, Ralph Terry from the 1960 World Series. And it seemed like Mike Mussina was one of the highlights of the book, or at least one of the pitchers who gave you the most insight and just really revealing how obsessive he was about every pitch and what the situation entailed. And I always find it interesting for pitchers like that. Did Mussina strike you as someone who maybe in this day and age would have been, you know, embracing this new wave of advanced stats, kind of like a Trevor Bauer in terms of how much he obsesses with his spin rate and pitch percentages and things like that? Did Mussina or any other Yankee kind of strike you as someone who would have taken that stuff and ran with it if they were pitching today?
That's a really interesting question, because I think Mussina is smart enough that if he had grown up in this generation, and if that was sort of his normal, his reality, that he would have been all over it. But to take him from his generation and now, he's not a big fan of it. Like he's not sitting there at home, you know, eating up all these newfangled stats. In fact, he didn't. You know, he is very dismissive of the idea of spin rate, because he thinks it's not indicative of whether a pitch is going to be a good pitch or not. You need command and you need to know when to use it. I think he was much bigger on intuition and reading the moment, reading all, putting all those factors into your brain and you figuring it out, versus maybe a little bit more of a predetermined script. So I think with his perspective and his background, if you just plopped him down in the middle of this right now, he would not like it at all. But I think he's so smart that if he had grown up with it, he would eat it up. It would be a big asset for him.
And another aspect of today's baseball is teams are so guarded in terms of holding a competitive advantage. You even look at a guy like Brian Cashman, who it won't reveal anything about his massive analytics departments or what the Yankees do to gain an edge. And then you have Mariano Rivera in your book, and you mentioned on Brandon Steiner's podcast last week about how open he was about just showing his cutter grip to opponents, which was his secret weapon. I mean, just now in the Hall of Fame, in the first unanimous Hall of Fame selection, just what does it say about his greatness that he was basically like, here's what I do, I'll show you how to do it, but you won't be able to repeat it?
Well, I think he's, you know, a very generous guy, and I think that there's sort of a brotherhood among pitchers that, you know, that they're willing to talk shop with each other. I mean, we had a thing a couple years ago, right, where, you know, Pedro Martinez was helping out Luis Severino, you know, in the offseason of the Red Sox. Like, hey, you know, you work for us. You're a Red Sox guy. But I think it's just sort of a feeling that, you know, we can help each other out. And also, I think pitchers understand that, like, just because I show you a grip doesn't mean you're going to be able to do it. You know, like John Smoltz was telling me from the book about how he played with, you know, guys who threw changeups at a Hall of Fame level, you know, with Glavin and even Maddox. And he, you know, he just couldn't get that pitch. So, you know, you can tell someone how to do stuff. You know, Halladay can ask Rivera, you know, am I doing something wrong with a thumb placement on my cutter? But it's kind of up to Halladay and his physiology and the way his hand moves to be able to pick that up or not. So obviously he did, and he took that improved cutter and made it the featured pitch for the last three big years of his career, 09, 10, 11. And certainly some of the Yankees weren't thrilled with that with Rivera for helping him out, but there's still no guarantee it was going to work.
And you mentioned Luis Severino, who got knocked around in the playoffs last year. It was later possibly revealed that he was tipping pitches. And then you have James Paxton in his last start, now being revealed that he was possibly tipping his pitches, which could have led to him getting knocked around. And it was actually Carlos Beltran who pointed it out to him. And, you know, I don't know if you've discussed this with any pitchers for your book, but, you know, how does tipping pitches sometimes start to happen when mechanics get flawed? And do you think it's a concern that the pitching coaches and Larry Rothschild and company over at the Yankees weren't able to point that out, and it came from actually a more external source? I know Beltran's a special advisor to the Yankees, but it almost seems like that could have been seen from the dugout, from the pitching coaching staff.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I haven't really dug in yet to ask, you know, if that was something that the coaches were aware of. But, you know, certainly it's good to have Beltran on their payroll, because he's the kind of guy who sees so much. But that is something. I mean, that's when a pitcher's struggling, he shouldn't be struggling based on his track record and or his health. That is something that everybody should go to. You know, I mean, you look at certain pitchers right now around the league. Aaron Nola's been pretty bad, and you know, there's a lot of guys who, you know, Syndergaard, you know, a lot of guys whose stats just don't match up with their pedigree, and you wonder, you know, if they are tipping, and that's something that is a real issue now because you know, of so much video and so many people paid to just analyze video, you know, that. Pitchers often have tells, and it's a lot easier to pick up those tells, you know, nowadays than it was before. Maybe just with a really smart hitter and you know, in the dugout trying to figure it out. So yeah, pitchers have to be really aware of that. I mean, we saw last year in the playoffs. I remember talking to Cora. I think it was Cora. No, it was Dana LaVangie, the Red Sox pitching coach, in the Houston locker room last year after Kimbrel had pitched really well in game five, and I'm like, what was the difference? He's like, well, he was tipping his pitches. He was doing this with his club before, and now we told him to knock that out. So, you know, that took the Red Sox several playoff games to really figure that out. So I guess it's not easy, but hitters are trying to stay ahead, that's for sure.
Tyler, another pitcher that's been struggling for the Yankees has been Jay Happ, and I know when he signed, some people were concerned given his age and that he was a predominantly fastball pitcher. How, in your opinion, how does a pitcher that relies on his fastball like Jay Happ does, that's diminishing, how does he stay relevant, and do you think he can sort of get out of this funk that he's in if his command improves?
Well, yeah, I think it's all about the command with him. I mean, Jay Happ's one of the guys, you know, sort of the prime examples that I use or that anybody can use, of what a fastball with life really means compared to, you know, what the radar gun says. You know, the miles per hour is only one ingredient in Jay Happ. I mean, he has that fastball that he can usually, if he's spotting it well, he can survive up in the zone, even though he doesn't throw that hard, because the pitch just doesn't fall. It's got like the kind of a rising illusion to the hitters. because of the spin rate on it. And I haven't checked the spin rate numbers right now to tell you how that compares to previous years. But generally, he's always been the kind of guy who could live, you know, with fastball high in the zone as long as he had command. Because it behaves differently on the way to the plate than most guys' fastball. So, again, the track record's so good there recently that I wouldn't worry about it too much because it is so early. But it is time to mix in a good start there. It's past time for that. So it's definitely. I mean, he's one of the healthy guys, you know, and he's not performing. So the Yankees, everybody's hurt, so they sure can't afford to have a guy who's healthy not performing.
Absolutely, and another Yankee that there were some velocity concerns about, although his last start out he was hitting triple digits with relative ease, was Aroldis Chapman. And I know in your book you detail kind of the evolution of Trevor Hoffman. Given the devastating slider that he has, do you think as Chapman's velocity diminishes as he ages, he'll still be able to be an effective pitcher if he semi-reinvents himself?
I think so. I've always been a Chapman guy. I just, in a sense that, I just keep going back to how it's easy for people to get on him for giving up the home run to Rajay Davis in the World Series, but people tend to forget that he went through Santana, Lindor, and Kipnis 1-2-3 in the ninth inning and a home run would have lost the World Series there with, you know, not throwing 100 and you know, tricking them with whatever 97 and sliders. So I think he's a tough guy. I think he can figure it out. I think you're right. The slider is a really good pitch. And I don't know enough to know about his relationship with like a CC Sabathia, but I think as long as CC's around, CC is such a great leader, that I think he's a good example and a good resource, for a guy like Chapman or anybody. If they're looking to, you know, sustain excellence, and reinvent themselves maybe a little bit as their stuff changes. You know, CC's shown that, you know, that he can do that. And that's what the great ones do. You know, I look at Chapman as a great one. I look at him as really, you know, a special pitcher, and those guys tend to, you know, evolve over time. So I just don't worry about him.
Gosh, yeah, it's really cool how CC has become this leader, kind of inheriting it from Andy Pettit, who sort of passed on the tricks of pitching as you aged as a lefty to him. Both of those guys have provided us with tons of great Yankee memories, and I know in your book you highlight a lot of great pitching moments and Yankee pitching moments. Were there any Yankee moments that didn't make it into the book that were close runner-ups that, you know, obviously if the book was a little longer you would have included?
Well, I feel like I did a pretty, you know, I'm trying to think if there were a whole lot of cutting room floor stuff with the Yankees. Probably not a ton. I mean, I wanted to touch on just enough of the Yankee, you know, kind of legends, sort of the living legends. I mean, you know, Whitey Ford's obviously not in a position anymore to give interviews, but, you know, I was able to, you know, get some stuff out of his book and from some people who pitched with him about, you know, some of the trickery he was able to do late in his career. And maybe that doesn't give him credit for all the times when he wasn't cutting the ball. But, you know, certainly he was a legend. I was thankful that Ralph Terry is still with us to tell his stories you know, pitching Game 7 in 1960 and 1962 and how he avoided giving up another Game 7 walk-off and ended up with, you know, being the hero in 62. I thought that was a really fun story to tell. You know, for dealing with Ron Guidry and Gossage and Rivera and Pettin and a little bit of Clemens and Messina, obviously. You know, the Yankees have such a great tradition in that aspect. And also Phil Niekro. I mean, Phil Niekro happened to get in, you know, with the Yankees for when he won his 300th game, and telling that story was fun, too. You know, a little bit of Jim Bouton. Maybe I could have done a better job. You know, I could have gotten into more Mel Stottlemyre stuff. He's kind of a overlooked Yankee pitcher just because of the era he happened to pitch in. He had 64 in the World Series, and then, you know, then didn't get back to the postseason until he was a coach. Probably could have gotten into Mel. Obviously, unfortunately, his health was declining for most of the time I was researching the book. So that might be one I could have gotten into a little bottom line stuff in there probably. But you know, I talked to Jim Abbott about his, you know, how he was able to be so dominant, you know, with for his little time there with a cutter. I'd have to think a little bit, but yeah, maybe I could, you know, give it a little more love to Mel for the great pitcher that he was.
And all the names you mentioned, is that part of what makes the book so great is that it covers so many different decades of pitching and just how the mind of a pitcher has evolved and how so much of it has stayed the same. And, you know, a big part of today's game in terms of some fans' criticism is the number of strikeouts. And while a lot of people attribute that to, you know, launch angle and trying to capitalize on home runs and an effort to score runs, a lot of it is also attributed to the incredible velocity that every arm in the major league seems to have right now. When you talk to the, you know, the Terrys and the Boutons, who was a knuckleballer, but, you know, pitchers from yesteryear, do they ever give any insight into, you know, what the difference in terms of velocity and stuff might have been back then? I know we have, you know, the Ottavinos joking that he would have struck out Babe Ruth, and a lot of people agreeing with him because they argue that the pitching just wasn't the same back then as it is today. Did any of them compare, like, what they thought the evolution was in today's pitching in terms of miles per hour and just movement on off-speed pitches?
I think some of it, you know, where I really got into that was kind of in writing about the stinker. You know, sort of the guys like another Yankee, Tommy John, well, Yankee among many other teams. But, you know, they don't really seem to understand, I guess, or they lament, you know, what has happened to the sinker, in that it was always, you know, a pitch that guys love because they could throw it, they could, you know, have a low pitch count and get through games pretty quickly and have them put the ball in play on the ground, weak contact, and obviously, hitters have tailored their swings to hit that pitch in the air now, and teams, you know, would rather you avoid contact because the more contact, the more possibility that things could happen. And I mean, it is a different game. It's a different game. Well, Oral Hirsch, I just said this when I said it's a different game. He said it's a different game theory. It's the same game, and the theories now is that, you know, make them miss bats, and so, you know, teams covet these guys who, you know, these high strikeout guys, even if they go fewer innings, because, you know, like, look with how the Yankees constructed this team. This team is not constructed to have the starters go really deep in games because they have a lot of strikeout guys and dominant arms to, you know, to fill in 6, 7, 8, 9. So, you know, you're just not asking your starter to do what you used to ask them to do. And the best weapon for a lot of those old starters was to not, you know, not push it full throttle, to take a little bit off and get ground balls and you know, be a little craftier out there. I think they, you know, they recognize that the velocity and how hard these guys are throwing, but they lament you know, maybe the absence of, let's say, craftsmanship out there or that kind of canny, savvy mindset to just get ground balls and quick innings and keep going. But part of that has to do with the hitters, too. Hitters know they get paid by working deep counts and, you know, foul balls off and taking close pitches. So it's all kind of goes hand in hand.
We're talking with Tyler Kepner of the New York Times and author of the book K. And I know last week with Brandon Steiner, he asked you your Mount Rushmore of pitchers. I think Walter Johnson and even Randy Johnson was on there. But if we were to narrow that down to Yankees, if you had to name a Mount Rushmore of Yankees pitchers, relievers can be included as well, which obviously probably includes an obvious answer. But if you had to give a Mount Rushmore of Yankees arms, what do you think it would look like?
That's a really good question. It's funny. I thought my son always asked me about, he's a big basketball fan. He always asked me, like, you know, would Kobe Bryant even make the Lakers round Mount Rushmore? Because you got Kareem, you got Magic, you got, you know, Wilt and Jerry West. How does Kobe even get on that list? But that's the first thing I thought of. But I mean, wow, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, first off, you know, you got to put Whitey Ford and you got to put Mo on there. So, you know, those two, you know, lock them up. And then you're looking at other ones. You know, the Yankees, it's funny, have a lot of Hall of Fame type pitchers that people don't think much, you know, don't remember much of, because as great as the Yankees are in their history, they have a lot of these pitchers, you know, the 50s teams that would come in, you know, they'd have one or two great years and then it sort of fade. They didn't have that longevity. you know, talk about a Terrier or a Bob Turley kind of guys. But for longevity, I mean, Idrey was really good for a long time. He's not, you know, didn't make the Hall of Fame, didn't really get any love from the voters, but for, you know, for a 9 or 10 year period, you talk about 77 to 86, 85, 86, and he was in the pantheon up there, and there's some pretty good years there. So I think I'd put Idrey on the Mount Rushmore. And then you're talking about, well, do you take a guy who, I mean, like Clemens was a Yankee for 5 years or so, and he's one of the greatest pitchers of all time, but most of that was with Boston, and I don't know that I could put Clemens on there because he had a greater career than like a Pettit, let's say. I mean, Mel was great, but didn't pitch for a lot of winning teams, let's say. You had, you know, Herb Pennock and guys like that, Red Ruffing, who don't get a lot of attention. So then I'm thinking, well, we kind of got Rivera to represent the Torrey years and the Girardi years. Maybe you go with, I might go with a Red Ruffing. I mean, Red Ruffing was a Hall of Famer. He was the ace of those great teams in the early DiMaggio career. The later Ruth years that bridged to the early DiMaggio years. Not an inner circle Hall of Famer. It took them a while to get in. I'd probably put Red Ruffing on there. I think high ERA for Hall of Famer, and Andy's certainly more famous. But to maybe showcase the earlier years, let's throw Red Ruffing on there. Why not?
All right, there you go. A solid list. That's Tyler Kepner of the New York Times, and his new book, K, is out. It's been out since April 2nd, I believe, and it's a fabulous read. Recommend it to anybody. Tyler, thank you so much for coming on, and enjoy the games out there tonight. I know you'll be at the stadium.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks, guys.
Okay, huge thanks to Tyler Kepner. Again, his book K is out now. Highly recommend it to anyone who hasn't given it a read yet. And, it's just really interesting stuff that pitchers go through and what they dissect about their own delivery. And now you have, from a Yankees perspective, he mentioned the Severino tipping pitches in the ALDS. And now it seems like Paxton was tipping pitches in his last start when he got bombed. And, what do you think, Sean? For me, and I know I asked Tyler this when we talked to him, but for me, I just feel like that's something that I kind of wish the pitching coach, Larry Rothschild, would be able to see something like that instead of having Carlos Beltran, a day later saying, hey, looks like you were tipping pitches out there, and then they go back to the video and it's like, oh, yeah, you know what, he's right. I just feel like this is stuff that, needs to be addressed while it's happening. And again, I think we talked about this on the podcast after the season ended last year, when the whole Lance Lynn debacle and everything happened for when Boone's in-game managing was just awful. But I also was kind of hoping for Larry Rothschild to be a little bit of a rock for Boone in his early, his early years as a manager, when he's still getting the hang of it, because Rothschild's been in the dugout for a while and he's the pitching coach. Maybe he can help him and be like, hey, those last three balls were hit at over 105 miles an hour. Like, I don't know if he has it anymore. Or, hey, looks like Paxton's doing something with his glove. I think pitchers might know when the off-speed's coming. It's just something like that.
Yeah. With the mechanics and the way that they're getting hit, I think that's more on Rothschild. Like, but tipping pitches, maybe not so much. I think that should be a concerted effort from everybody. I mean, the hitters should be looking at the pitchers. I mean, like Beltran was, basically, even though he's not a hitter anymore. But it would have been nice if Rothschild picked that up while he was observing Pap's mechanics, for sure. I'm sorry, Paxton's mechanics, for sure.
Nothing's wrong with Pap's mechanics. He's just bad right now.
Yeah. So, I'm not going to freak out on Rothschild for not picking up something subtle. I mean, I know that's something you have to go back and dissect. And oddly enough, I know Beltran pointed out it was an issue when there was runners on second base. And I believe Paxton did pretty well while there were runners on second base. So, I mean, who knows what's going on. We'll see tonight when he pitches against the Red Sox.
Who should be an easier test than the White Sox,
based on Orioles.
Yeah, based on how they're hitting right now.
Yeah.
So, Paxton tonight. We have a little two-game series with Boston as the rivalry is basically down to a simmer right now, based on how both teams are playing. So, you know, the Yankees are 6-9. Obviously, this is a huge, tall order, but if the Yankees win three games in a row, they're 9-9, exactly where they were last year when they won 100 games. It's very early. I'm trying to find the positives, but it's very early.
Well, I mean, they don't have the lineup they had when they started 9-9 and won 100 games right now. So we'll see. I mean, between that and then how bad Hap has been, there's a lot wrong that needs to get fixed, a real lot.
Yeah, Hap was asking CC for help during CC's postgame presser on Saturday, asking how he was able to paint the corners because Hap's command has not been there. I think that's the big key for the Yankees right now. We just have to accept that the people that are injured are probably not coming back very soon. Aside from, you hope Sanchez. They said it was a true 10-day IL stint. We'll see about that. But aside from him, it doesn't seem like many guys are due back soon.
What about Stanton? Do you think he'll be back within the next 2 weeks?
I don't know. I mean, if it's similar to Sanchez's bicep strain last year, or in 2017, excuse me, then he would be due back in a couple weeks. But I don't, what, he's been doing what, just T-work right now?
Yeah, I believe so.
So, I don't know, might push that to 3 weeks probably at this point. And so what it comes down to is the guys that are here and are established, the few established parts of the roster left, from Judge, Voit, and Torres to the bullpen and Happ and Paxton, those guys just need to step up and produce. And the lineup portion of that, you know, Torres went through a brief cold stretch, but I think he'll be fine. Judge and Voit are fine. It needs, you know, it's mainly the pitching right now. Chad Green has to be better. Yeah, Chad Green has looked lost. That's unfortunate considering how dominant he was in 2017. And, you know, so many people are saying, like, oh, he's been downhill since 2017. He still had a really solid 2018 season. He was just being compared to a ridiculous 2017 where he was, you know, probably a Rookie of the Year candidate if there weren't guys like Judge out there.
Yeah, he was great in 2017, really good last year, and just has not had it this year. Him and Britton both have been huge letdowns out of that bullpen.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if they can improve. But other than that, I think I've been sapped of my energy talking about this team.
So we hope that Paxton is fixed, even though that the situation with tipping pitches might not have actually been the cause of why he stunk. Hap, we just think stinks right now, and hopefully he learns how to control it. CeCe gave us a shot in the arm. Tanaka had a Tanaka start. And Domingo Herman, hopefully, when his next start comes around, keeps pitching like he has because he's been the Yankees' best pitcher. And then in the bullpen, Britton and Green need to step it up, and that would at least be a start.
Just those 10 things, and that would be
and
a
we
got
to get Sanchez back. Now, hopefully, again, with the Sanchez injury, I wish they had been on it earlier, but it is what it is. Hopefully it's only 10 days because he was, you know, he had the huge game. We were all excited. He had a nice, I think he had a couple doubles in the Houston series. Am I remembering that correctly?
You are. Sanchez has been, was incredible before he got hurt. And
then now we're back down to earth.
Yeah. Well, it's a dangerous time for players right now because if they feel like something's hurting, maybe they're like, oh, we already have too many injuries, I can't say anything. And then all of a sudden they sustain an injury that takes months to recover. So, you know, yep. Players, don't be stupid. Other injured players, don't, you know, be stupid and coming back too soon before you're, you know, back on the shelf for a month again. Just get healthy. And for the Yankees that are still alive, tread water. before those colossal Giants in first place, the Tampa Bay Rays, get too far in front.
Don't make fun of the Rays. They're a good team.
They have been outstanding since summer of last year. Mm-hmm. And then they released CJ Krohn. Everyone was laughing at him. And then they signed Charlie Morton. And now they're, oh, man, Tyler Glass now. They're good.
Hell of a lot better than we are.
Yeah, well, so are a lot of teams right now. So is there anything, keeping with tradition, is there anything you're looking forward to this week in Yankees universe? I'll just say mine real quick. I'm looking forward to, you know, I mean, this could jinx it, but I'm looking forward to watching a week of Yankee baseball where I don't see someone get hurt.
Well, that's just you're asking for trouble. So I'll start preparing funeral arrangements for Judge, because that's probably what's going to happen now that you said that. I'm not even looking forward to anything with the Yankees. I'm going to say something else. I bought the Lego Boba Fett ship, the slave one. I'm going to put that together this week and continue binging Game of Thrones, even though I'm not caught up yet. I'm going back. I'm not doing any Yankee stuff.
All right. So we're back to the off-season tradition.
Yeah, that's it. I've had it. The greatest moments of the last week had nothing to do with the Yankees. I found out I passed my master's exam and will graduate. I'm very happy and proud about that.
Congratulations.
Rangers came in second place to your Devils in the draft lottery. We're both very happy about that.
Yeah, that was a fun night.
That was a great day. And then the Yankees start playing at 7 o'clock. You think, all right, here we go. And then they just sap all the life out of you. And I'm not happy no more because the Yankees stink. So, that's it. So I'm trying to look towards non-Yankee things to pick me up.
Yes. Well, thanks. So, thanks to everyone that listened. The moral of the podcast is that everything stinks and everyone is hurt.
And if you're 31 years old, the only thing you could do to bring you joy is watch Game of Thrones and build Legos.
That sounds like a great night to me, actually.
But I can't do both. Like, I build Legos while I watch the Yankees, because you don't need to be so focused. Like Game of Thrones, I have to just sit down and do nothing else.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm looking forward to a new Game of Thrones this weekend. So there is something. There's light on the horizon. Hopefully there is, too, for the Yankees. Hopefully some reinforcements come back. But first, rivalry.
Yay.
I feel about as excited saying that as in Always Sunny when they're talking about the Flipadelphia rivalry when they're over it.
yeah, that's...
Well... Hopefully there's some kind of spark from the Yankees starting tonight, taking on Boston. So everyone, try your best to enjoy the game. Say a prayer for the health of everyone on the field. And thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
See you later, everybody. If anybody gets hurt, blame Ryan.
Blame me.